following is a conversation between Tanya Allen, president of the McKnight Foundation, and Denver Frederick, the host of The Business of Giving.
The Robin Hood Foundation is dedicated to combating poverty in New York City through a range of innovative and impactful initiatives. It stands out for its strategic approach to philanthropy, focusing on partnerships, technology, effective use of data, and direct community engagement to drive meaningful change. And here to discuss this with us is Richard Bury, the Chief Executive Officer of the Robin Hood Foundation. Welcome to The Business of Giving, Rich.
Thank you so much, Denver. Good to be here.
Can you give us a snapshot of the Robin Hood Foundation? You know, what's your main mission and what kind of initiatives are you focusing on to tackle poverty in New York City?
Well, Robin Hood's mission has been pretty consistent over the 35 years we've been in business. Our mission is to fight poverty in New York City. So what that really means is that we invest in the most impactful organizations, the most effective leaders who are driving program innovations that have a demonstrable impact in moving families out of poverty. And when we talk about that, what we really mean is helping families make the long-term move that it takes to live lives of stability and opportunity. So as you said, one of the hallmarks of that work is our real focus on evidence and impact. We use a paradigm that we call the benefit cost calculator that essentially tries to understand what is the actual poverty fighting impact of a particular dollar in a particular program is measured by the outcomes associated with whatever output you get with that dollar. So if you graduate from high school, what is the long-term value of that high school diploma in your life? And we're not an endowed foundation. So we go out every year and we go out and raise money to do this work here in New York. And one of the benefits for people who donate to Robin Hood is that our board underwrites our operating costs so that when you give a dollar to Robin Hood, that dollar goes out to an organization doing work out in the field.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting not being an endowed organization. I don't know what it does to a culture of an organization, but I think it keeps it hungrier in some ways. You know, it's just you're scrappier than you would be if you had a big endowment.
I wouldn't mind having a big endowment, of course. It's interesting. I don't necessarily think that having an endowment stops you from being scrappy. I think certainly for us, it enhances our need to be responsive because the number of constituencies we have to be responsive to include our government partners. They include the nonprofits we work with, the people we serve, but it also includes the donors who have expectations about how their dollars are driving impact. So I think having a broad range of people to whom you're accountable certainly matters. And that's definitely true for Robin Hood.
You said in your previous answer about the long-term impact of moving families, how do you balance immediate needs in New York City with systemic causes? That's a hard balance to keep. I was wondering how you set your priorities based on immediate concerns and systemic change.
That's a great question. I think balance is the right way to think about it. As I said, our focus is on moving people permanently out of poverty by helping people achieve those evidence-based milestones that we know are associated with long-term, lifelong wealth. So things like having a job, third grade reading scores, maternal health. So from early childhood up until people are out into the workforce, making sure that people are achieving those milestones. But we also know that it is impossible for anyone to focus on their long-term well-being to make investments in their future if you're not stable right now. I mean, it's hard to think about going back to a job training program if you can't feed your family, if you don't have a place to live. And so, and you'll see in our portfolio that there really is a balance between those investments we might think of short-term emergency investments and other investments like education programs or workforce programs that have a longer time horizon to yield impact. But I would say a couple of things. One thing is that even for the so-called emergency programs, there are ways to think about and implement those programs in a way that are more likely to drive longer-term outcomes. We have historically been New York City's largest funder of emergency food assistance. But you'll see in many of our food assistance programs that are, of course, focused on day-to-day needs of people who are facing food insecurity, who are facing hunger. You'll also see programs that are working on connecting people so they have access to long-term public benefits, helping people navigate things like housing eviction or other challenges, which are part of the mess of challenges that ultimately keep people from food accesses because you don't have enough money. And maybe you don't have enough money because you're spending it on rent or you're spending it on other needs or you're spending it on emergency medical care. So one thing is that even in the emergency work, we try to find and try to invest in organizations that are committed to a long-term horizon for the families in need. And the second thing is when New York City has faced big crises, one of the things that Robinhood is proud of is that at three different times in our history, 9/11, Hurricane Sandy, and during the pandemic, Robinhood has gone out and raised large relief funds entirely focused on providing emergency assistance to people in need and the people who supported them, including making sure that victims of 9/11, their families received checks in the mail just to help them get through a difficult time. So we really feel like it's not a choice between one or the other, but you're absolutely right. With limited resources, trying to make sure that you have a portfolio that meets people's needs today, but also make sure that when you're helping somebody meet their immediate needs today, the ideal is that that person doesn't have to come back tomorrow or the next day, that you help them get a leg up so that they can move forward in life and that you have the capacity to help the next person who comes along.
Yeah. So you have a holistic view of it and you help them for today, but you have an eye on their future as you do it and knowing that that's where we want to go. You know, New York City is so incredibly diverse and it's constantly changing. I think about the changes that probably have occurred, Rich, since you've been in that chair 2.5 years ago. They're monumental, I would imagine. How do you keep up in identifying and assessing these changing needs in all the communities that you serve?
Yeah, I mean, I think 2.5 years ago, no one would have really predicted the impact of migration, particularly from Central America, but also from Africa and other countries that have become so much a part of the daily life of everyone in New York. You know, I think a few things. One is, part of it is just about being part of an ecosystem. I think one of the advantages for Robinhood is being a truly local organization. I mean, our work in New York is that our ears are to the ground because we're in the community. We fund some 300 community-based organizations and neighborhoods across the city. We develop deep relationships with many of those partners so that we are, hopefully, if we're doing our job right, developing good and close relationships with those in the field to understand where the world is shifting. A big part of our work involves partnership with government. We know that even as the largest local philanthropy focused on poverty, in a typical year, we are investing $140 million or more in poverty-fighting initiatives, that is still dwarfed by the need in New York. It's certainly dwarfed by New York City's $100 billion budget or New York State's budget, which is twice that. And so we see a big part of our work as influencing the work of government as a partner, as an innovation partner, as a thought partner, and sometimes as an advocate. More and more in the last few years, we have funded advocacy as part of our work to try to get governments to respond to what the evidence tells us is actually going to win in the fight against poverty. And so I think all those things really come together. And the last thing I'll say is research. I wouldn't describe ourselves as an institution that sort of funds research for the purposes of research, but we do fund very practical research, including when there are questions that we'd like to understand the answer to help drive our funding. One of the things that we're the most proud of is a partnership with Columbia University, something called a poverty tracker, where we follow longitudinally a group of New Yorkers with lived experience in poverty, and we interview them several times a year to get feedback about their lived experiences. How are they experiencing the challenges of life in New York in a way that sometimes the raw data can't elucidate? And that can help us sort of figure out, well, here's where we need to focus on, here's what we need to learn more about, because this is how people are actually, this is the thing that is helping people or hurting people or holding people back right now. So we try to learn, but you got to bring it all, approach it all, I think, with a sense of humility, which is the truth is we try to keep our ears to the ground, but we're not on the ground. We are not the ones teaching the kids or those who are returning home from incarceration. We're not running the child care centers. And so trying to bring our research bent and our methodology and our focus on results, but also to bring that with a real spirit of inquisitiveness and humility and listening to people on the ground, including more and more listening to the people who are on the receiving end of services through things like the poverty track and other things that we do to try to make sure that our dollars are being deployed as impactfully as is humanly possible.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I love the partnership you have with Columbia because sometimes I feel at least that this evidence-based work can be too narrowly defined, as you say, the statistics and the math and not enough to the human experience. And not everything shows up in a chart. And that really is the kind of smoothing out that is really necessary to understand what needs to be done.
Yeah, you need all of that evidence and then you need to apply human judgment against it. And ultimately, there are human beings that are making these decisions. We can't actually plug numbers into the benefits cost calculator and then decide, okay, well, we do this and not that. ultimately, human judgment has to be borne against all of this evidence. And so we try to bring that humility to our decision making.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the Power Fund, and that focuses on addressing underinvestment in organizations led by people of color. Share with us some examples of how this initiative has really made an impact.
Yeah, the Power Fund is something that my predecessor started, and it really came out of research from Echoing Green and the Bridgespan Group, which really showed what really shouldn't be a surprise, that as philanthropy has grown, Black and Latino-led and Asian-led organizations have not benefited from that growth. And that shouldn't be surprising in a society where racism continues to drive who leads organizations, continues to drive who sits in seats of power, drives where resources go. That's no different in philanthropy than it is in government or in business or any other sector. So philanthropy doesn't have a particular sin here, but certainly as a part of the world so comprehensively focused on justice and opportunity, I think we have a responsibility to hold ourselves accountable. And so the Power Fund really asked, what can we as an organization do to identify and support organizations led by people of color? And in part because we were just talking about listening to the voices of those who are affected, we know that organizations that are led by people of color that have diverse leaders, like all organizations with diverse leaders, make better decisions, or the research is overwhelming. But also the idea that the greater chance that organizations that are led by people of color that are connected to communities that we're serving are going to be better positioned to do the work. And so what we found when we started this work in July of 2020, we found that 30% of our total grants went to organizations led by people of color. So a little bit less than a third. And those organizations received 20% of our funding. So they were about a third of our organizations we funded, and they received disproportionately fewer grants. Yeah. As we sit on the other side, 3 years later, what we now find is that organizations led by people of color constitute 48%. So basically half of our grantees, and they also receive half of the grants awarded. I will say part of that is about a broader shift in the sector. It's an ongoing shift, one that I think was amplified after the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and sort of the broader public awareness of the need for diversity, equity, inclusion in our institutions. And so some of that is us just following the field, but it's also about our intentional work. And one of the things that we found, which is so important to me, is that those organizations have a higher renewal rate in terms of Robin Hood grants than our broader pool. You know, we, again, as an evidence-based investor, organizations come out of our portfolio as they don't demonstrate results. But what this suggests is that by bringing this focus on organizations led by people of color, it has not reduced quality by our typical measures. It's presumably increased quality because those organizations are getting funded more. And what we're trying to do now is the Power Fund at Robinhood was, when we started, a separate pool of grant making. What we've tried to do now is to bring those disciplines, to bring those expectations into our standard grant making pool, so that it's not that there's one group that is focused on making grants in this space, but so that every one of our teams has expectations around how it is showing up in communities, holding themselves accountable for identifying and putting forward organizations who have non-traditional leadership. And so I really think it's been a transformative initiative here at Robinhood.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm guessing, having had some other conversations, that a lot of these local organizations led by people of color really surfaced during the pandemic. Because you began to see who was doing the great work on the ground, and you're saying, wow, why weren't they on our radar to begin with? I'm sure glad they are now.
100%. You know, I hate to say this. I want to say there's no silver lining to the pandemic, but I don't want to say that. But certainly what has happened regularly with us after these relief funds, including the pandemic relief fund, is you identify these small grassroots organizations who don't typically meet the... We're a challenging funder in a lot of ways because of our expectations around evidence of impact. Sometimes it can take a relatively sophisticated organization to be able to sort of manage the relationship. You know, we're trying to get better, but it is, I think, part of what it means to deal with Robinhood. But as you say, we have found a lot of organizations that we didn't know. I mean, found is not the right word. They were there doing the work, in many cases long before we showed up on the scene, but at least new to us, that we found because they applied for a small grant to provide emergency cash assistance to people in their community. And you meet these leaders, you see these work. And sometimes my challenge to the staff is that if there's an organization that we see is doing great work, but they can't compete for funding for us because of the way we're set up, that may not be their fault. That may be our fault. And so What is it about, how can we, without giving up these principles and standards, because ultimately, I think the reason why we're so focused on impact, not because donors want it or the donors love that language, but because people deserve it. Like, people deserve services that work for them, that actually change their lives. They deserve more than people who are working hard and trying their best. They deserve interventions that actually are impactful. But our process doesn't always find those organizations because, as you talked about before, we sometimes have limited ways of evaluating them, but also limited ways of identifying them. Our networks are limited by who we are and who we know. So the pandemic relief funds have been a great way to introduce organizations. Some of those became Power Fund grantees, and some of those are now part of our grant-making portfolio.
And just at that point, it really is, I think, forces us to have a real reassessment of what best practices are. Because best practices are the way things have always been done. No certain criteria. And it's been looking at how these organizations have performed, as you said, and getting a renewal rate even better, that you begin to say, well, maybe these best practices were pretty stale, pretty limited, pretty codified, and there are different ways to solve problems, and maybe we need to be more open-minded about those.
That's right. I mean, it's so easy for the best ideas and the best notions to go overboard and to have the tail begin to wag the dog. And so it also forces us, as you were saying, to think differently about evidence in a number of ways, including taking advantage of evidence that just really didn't exist in a way that was accessible to organizations like Robinhood a decade ago. So our benefit cost calculator, as I described, the benefit cost ratios are based on the best evidence we can find. So I go back to high school diploma, because it's the easiest thing to imagine. We know that a high school diploma has value in the marketplace, a college degree even more. And so if you invest in an organization and they have an 80% high school graduation rate versus the expected 40% graduation rate for an organization serving that demographic in that place, and you know that each of those diplomas is worth X dollars in over a lifetime, you can begin to build a model of like how our dollars are driving impact. And that's great, but there's a couple of challenges. One is that the research is not always complete and up to date. We don't have developed evidence on every intervention. Even when we do, the evidence doesn't always speak the same language. And so part of the challenge is, how do we constantly update our models to reflect the best evidence? But the second challenge is that even in all those models, it's all predictive. It's based on 8 years ago, somebody did a research study based on this intervention. And so now if we see fidelity and we're seeing the same outputs, we're assuming the same long-term outcomes. But now we know that cities and states and the federal government have all sorts of rich data that don't require prediction, that we can actually understand that this person within this program for 4 years, and now they're doing this. And so thinking about how we can really engage with public actors and governments to really utilize population level administrative data to really understand how different institutions have been making a difference in the lives of people in New York, I think of another place that we want to go. And then the last thing I would say is continuing to push the envelope on what it means to listen to those who we actually serve. I talked about our poverty tracker research with Columbia. We have another initiative called the Design Insight Group, which is a group of a few thousand people, again, with lived experience of poverty, that basically form a database, which serve basically as a customer group, a customer impact group for some of the innovations we fund through one of our programs, Blue Ridge Labs, which essentially funds technology-based innovations in poverty. So we pay these people to test products, say, what are the things you most need? And to play with these products that these grantees are developing to see, is this tool to help you utilize food stamps? Is that a tool that you would use? What does it need? How is it working? I think one of the things about philanthropy that is always the most fascinating to me, and that I think at the heart makes this work so much harder than so much other work, is that at the end of the day, the people who pay for this stuff are not the people who use it.
Yep.
If I'm buying an apple from somebody, you can have some test of the value of the apple because I'm willing to pay for it. But just because a philanthropist is willing to pay $1,000 for an after-school program doesn't mean it's a great program. And the fact that a person who needs it doesn't have $1,000 doesn't mean it's not worth funding. And so trying to find ways to elevate the voices of those who actually benefit and to bring them in a rigorous way into our decision-making, I think for me is like, we're nowhere near there yet. We have some really great things that we are studying and deploying, but I feel like that's really the next level of my being able to go to a donor and say with confidence, yes, the dollar that you give me, I'm telling you, is going to be well deployed. It's going to be well deployed because the research evidence demonstrates it, because the administrative record proves it, because we have the track record of those who've come through it, and because the people who receive it are telling us that this is the kind of intervention that they want and they need.
Yeah. We've been woeful when it comes to beneficiary feedback. And it just seems as if we have that old notion of what charity is, and we're giving them a handout, so to speak, and they should be happy with whatever they get, and nothing could be farther from the truth. I was talking to someone the other day who was making that point, and they were saying that you ask us what we would work in this particular case, but you're telling us what the problem is. And you're asking us our opinion of the problem, but you're coming in with what of that it would be the best solution. And they said, that's not our problem. And they went on to say that you come in and try to fix things in our community. Why don't you put money in what's working well here? And that might eliminate the fixing thing. So we sort of go in where we think we're listening, but we go in, I think, from my experience in philanthropy, with too many assumptions of what people need. And then we let them weigh in based on that assumption.
Absolutely. And that those comments are so insightful. And I couldn't agree more. I think about our Design Insight group. This is a group of New Yorkers that I described before. So Blue Ridge Lab is essentially an incubator where we have classes of fellows who apply to come in and apply their technology skills to solve a problem. And much in keeping with that commentary, what we do first is we ask the Design Insight group, what are the problems we should be solving? So rather than, again, us, I wouldn't say speculating, it's never purely speculation. We're looking at research, we're looking at data, but we ask them what we should prioritize during this cycle. Then we go out and put that to RFP. We get fellowship applications. They help evaluate the fellowship applications. And then they decide both the quality of the products, and in this program, you can sort of progress as your product progresses. They help decide who progresses. And I think those comments are so insightful, including the idea about investing in what works. And another version of that, I think, is not just focused on solving crises after they occur, but also how do you help communities build wealth and equity and power so that they're in a better position to advocate for resources, better position to support their own institutions. And again, I will admit, I think that's just not often our mindset. And so we just all have to get there as a community. And one of the things that I love about a place like Robinhood, you started talking about what does it mean to not have an endowment that we can rely on to drive all of our work. One of the things that it gives us that puts us in relationship with a large number of wealthy and influential people who care about New York. And I think part of what we also try to do is to be a bridge for those people as well.
Yeah.
Well-meaning people actually understand what's happening in the field by bringing them in proximity to those in need, by bringing them evidence that challenges their assumptions about what actually matters and doesn't. And so it's a fun platform because I get to work, in all the, work with the government, get to work with donors, get to work with community organizations, and to try as best we can to bring all these amazing people together to do good work, to do the work of America, which is just building a country that works for everybody.
Yeah. Well, I have always considered Robinhood to be the ultimate 360 organization, and it really does enhance the understanding. And so many of us who work in the sector only have a 90 or a 180. We don't have a 360 where you can see how it all comes together and how it can work better. You know, you mentioned tech a moment ago, Rich. Tell us how you're using advanced tech, like AI, to boost your philanthropic efforts and outreach.
Oh, it's a work in progress. I think, first of all, like every other organization, mostly just me at the middle of the night playing with ChatGPT.
The only time you can get on.
Yeah. Anyway, just I've been playing a lot with the image generation in DALL-E. Anyway, it's fascinating technologies, obviously. But of course, that's just a cutting edge. You know, we all use AI all the time. You know, use a spell checker in Word, you're using AI, right? So it's either in some ways ubiquitous technologies. And I think the large language models that have sort of taken over the popular imagination. I think as I talk to people who work deeply in technology, the refrain I always hear that is amazing, that's going to change the world. But that's only the surface of the transformation that these technologies are impacting in society. So I think we look at it in two ways. I mean, one is, like every other organization, we're just trying to understand how all technology, but how AI can improve our process. And so there's various ways in which we're trying to use technology to better organize information, even thinking about how it makes a program officer's job easier. What do program officers spend their time doing, and are there tasks currently they're doing that could be done and supported through technology in a way that would expand the amount of time they had to go out in the field and engage with folks and to read research. And so I think like all the organizations, we think about it that way. But like most small organizations, you know, when I talk to some of our donors who sit on top of organizations, they are devoting tons of money to hiring teams.
Yeah.
It's more the work for them. For us, we don't really quite have that capacity. We have sort of our Skunk Works folks here and our sort of data intelligence team, which is basically a two-person team that are trying to think through these things. So on the one hand, we're just like everybody else, trying to trudge through, trying to learn what tools are out there. And really, we're on the early stages of thinking about how they have impacted us within an organization.
Yeah, I was speaking to Josh Burson the other day, and he was saying that's what nonprofits should do. Don't spend all the money up front. Let others do it. Have it settle out and decide what works. But he did say continue to learn, and that's something that you're doing. You're having an AI summit coming up, aren't you, on February 7th?
Exactly. And so the other thing I'm going to say is they're thinking about how AI helps us internally, but we want to think about what it will mean to the part of the world that we exist to serve. And the one thing that we know about technological innovations, I was just saying this to somebody the other day, that there's no better time to be alive for anyone than in 2024. And that's just the truth. It's true if you're poor, that's true. I mean, just for all the obvious reasons, even for those who are struggling deeply, for the most part, it's the best time to be alive, and technology plays a big role in that. And so I don't want to ever look at the world from a fear lens when it comes to technology. But we also know that the nature of technological innovation, that those innovations tend to benefit those who have the most benefits already. And the disruption that technology always brings tends to be most heavily experienced by those who are furthest from opportunity and resources. And when we see what's happening in a place like New York, that is really the concern. So our idea was to bring together the best technological minds in the world, bring together the businesses who are at the cutting edge of thinking about AI, and to put them in a room with policymakers, people in government, and put them in a room with people who have lived experience with poverty, and put them in a room with people who are leading organizations that are trying to meet needs, and to have a productive conversation. I mean, it's not that we believe we're going to solve, you know, it's a day-long conference, we're not going to solve the world, but we do believe we can begin a conversation. And for me, really focusing folks not only on the risk of harms, because we have to do that, and I do believe there's a lot of tension focused on the risks of harms, but what are the potential benefits? How do we make sure that the family in the Howard Houses in Brownsville has an opportunity to benefit from the innovations that are coming? When we think about things like financial inclusion in schools, where there are already proliferation of products, some good, some bad, too few directed towards the families who would most benefit from them, in healthcare, et cetera. So we're really excited about the conference. Again, it's on February 6th here in New York. And again, we're hoping it's the beginning of a conversation and connecting, like I said, a lot of organizations, companies that are led by people who, I believe both people are good. I think people who lead these companies, they want to do well for themselves, but they also want to have a positive impact on the world and helping them find a path to do that. By, as we were just saying, connecting them to people and the organization that are closest to challenges, and to say, well, how can the thing that I'm thinking about over here, what are the applications and implications for the people over there? And now that I have these relationships, how can we begin to work together to actually build some bridges and do some positive work for people who otherwise are more likely to get left behind?
Yeah, and as you said, as a nonprofit organization, you're playing to your strength. You don't have the deep pockets to get involved in AI, but you're the great convener and you bring people together, and that's where you make your contribution in a meaningful way. And I also think it's good to look at the positive aspects of what AI can do and then worry a little bit about some of the negative, because you want to start with what are the possibilities to impact positively humankind and think about what do we need to watch out for, as opposed to the other way around. I think that will lead to better outcomes. I'm going to ask you two quick questions.
Sure.
What idea in philanthropy is ready for retirement?
That's a great question. Part of me thinks that the answer to the question is that part of the problem is that philanthropy is in some ways a separate field, even separate from those who are delivering direct services. And that whenever you have a structure that sort of brings capital together, but the capital is fundamentally separate from the field, you're creating gaps. And so I think the practical way for I think about that is, like, when we hire people here, obviously we're trying to hire generally people who are bringing expertise in the field, who've run a program, who've worked in the field. And I think it would be great if more institutions viewed that as a cycle as opposed to a destination. So, like, if your work is in the social services sector, you shouldn't spend 15 years in direct service and then 20 years as a funder or whatever direction that works. But you spend 3 years in direct service and 3 years as a funder and 3 years in direct service and 3 years as a funder. It would be interesting. And I think some organizations think about places like Ford that sort of have built in the idea that you're going to be at Ford for a time. I would love the idea of thinking about philanthropy less as its own sector, if this makes sense, but as a place where people who are doing the work can come back, reflect, think about how to deploy resources back into field. And there's an ongoing conversation that's more dynamic because we're not sitting at separate on opposite sides of a semi-porous, but kind of a fence.
Yeah, that is really an interesting answer. I've never heard that before, but that's a really great insight. What idea in philanthropy you wish would be adopted widely today?
So nothing that is probably unique that I would say, but a lot of them we've already touched on. One is a more rigorous application of client perspective into decision-making. We just need to center the voices of people who receive services more. So I would start there. Better use of data and citywide and statewide and countywide administrative data, making that data more accessible to the institutions who are serving people so that people have real-time understanding of how their work interacts with the world. And then I think the thing that we always talk about and the thing that Robinhood is trying to get better at, more general operating support, more long-term funding, not because we want to remove rigor, because we do need to have rigor and accountability, but because we know that innovation takes time, good work takes time. You don't see outcomes in a year, and people don't have the sort of support they need to make quick decisions, to make investments. As a sector, we don't see all the impact we could because the people who lead the organizations are too hamstrung by limited funds, by having to convince somebody to take advantage of an opportunity because they don't have the resources on hand to do it. And so I think some of those things are all would lead to a more efficient, impactful sector.
Let me close with this, Rich. Share with listeners your leadership philosophy and how it influences your approach to tackling poverty in New York City through Robinhood.
Well, I don't know if it's much of a leadership philosophy, but I would always start and end with humility and listening, assuming that every room I go into, that I know the least about the problem, whether it's with my colleagues or government officials or the organizations or the folks. Going in with humility and open mind and open heart and listening. And then not being afraid to make decisions once you've done that homework. That's sort of the way I try to approach it. And that requires surrounding yourself with excellent people. You got to make sure that it's true. I'm proud to say that at Robinhood, that is maybe sadly for me, but almost always the case. I'm surrounded by people who just know a lot more about the work than I ever will. And learning from them and following their guidance. And then where I sort of fit that it's a little unique is that I get to sort of pull from all those people, pull the strands together, but then try to make a decision that reflects the breadth of views that are coming at me.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like facilitative leadership. You pretty much hold the conversation together, you connect the dots for everybody, and then you steer the ship in terms of where we need to go. For listeners who want to learn more about the Robinhood Foundation, tell us about your website and what visitors will find there.
Well, always. Well, thank you so much, first of all, Denver, for the time. We appreciate it. You can find us at www.robinhood.org. You can learn how to get involved, how to contribute resources, how to volunteer with organizations that we support. You can learn about the challenges of fighting poverty in New York, all of our research base, all the information is there. You can see the grantee, the places where the resources go, and you may not want to fund Robinhood, but you may see organizations that speak to you, and we love when people go to those organizations directly and support them. So come to robinhood.org. You can learn a lot. You can join the movement and you can help make New York a place that actually works for everyone.
Thanks, Rich, for a wonderful conversation. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to meet you.